Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to another episode of Early Work, the podcast in which I, Rhys James, invite a guest from the world of, I suppose, performance or writing to come and read to me their early work, the stuff they wrote, the creative stuff they wrote when they were a nipper, be it a teenager or a child or whatever, just before they did the job that they do now. This week, my guest is Mark Watson, one of the best comedians in the world. Absolutely exceptional comedian, incredibly inventive, always has been. One of my favourites, always been one of my favourites. And it turns out he was kind of this creative all along, very precocious child. He was writing extremely on-brand novels, age 7. He did actually have his first novel published when he was like 23, which is still pretty young for that. But no wonder, he put in the groundwork. He put so much hard copies of fiction with like front covers that he'd drawn and coloured in with like drawings of people on them, but also just like great 3D writing of like titles and stuff like that. Not 3D, that's not what 3D is, Rhys, get a grip. But he had all this sort of stuff. He also had a newspaper called the Daily Blah that he wrote when he was a kid that featured all sorts of local news as well as like a ton of adverts for the sort of things that you cannot imagine a six-year-old advertising. It was absolutely baffling. But it's a very good episode. Also, I read out a poem about the Garden of Eden, I think from the perspective of Eve, because that's how pretentious I was when I was 17. So I hope you enjoy it, and I will see you on the other side. Joining me this week on Early Work is the wonderful Mark Watson. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Rhys.
Hello. For listeners, Mark Watson is probably best known for when I was asked to appear on E4's All-Star Driving School. And then I said yes, and then I wasn't on it, and Mark Watson was on it instead.
Is that true?
I don't know if it was instead, but I watched it, and you were the comedian on the one I watched.
But you had been approached to do it?
Yeah, but only in like, are you free these dates? And yes, and I don't know how to drive. And then I was like, oh, who's the comedian then?
And it ended up being me. And I have to say, it was a miserable experience.
Was it really?
Well, yeah, you dodged
the
bullet
pass?
There. No, I did not. And I didn't even take the driving test in the end because I was so shaken up by the...
sorry to bring it up.
I had no experience driving at all. And it was one of these situations where they're like, everyone will be a bit useless, we'll have a laugh. Then you get there and you are just on a dual carriageway going at sort of 50 miles
are
an hour.
You?
They throw you straight in. Yeah.
Ah, see. Okay.
And I do not enjoy...
So also, just to clarify for anyone who hasn't seen All-Star Driving School, which I can't imagine is many, but
just in case you haven't... Someone
isn't it? It's like an intense... You have a week. You film for 5 days and it's like you learning to drive in a week and you're meant to take your test at the end of the week.
That's
and if you pass, they give you a Suzuki for a year.
That's right. But I quite quickly... My eyes were off the prize of the Suzuki. Just will I survive this this 5 day? It's quite, and obviously they knew I was quite a nervy person, so they put me with a driving instructor who, sort of raised my panic level by sort of shouting, "Come on, faster, gas it!" He kept saying, "Gas it, gas it,
gas it,
gas it." I want to see.
want to see 50.
He would yell, I want to see 50, as in miles per hour. And I was thinking, I'm not sure which one of these is the break.
And you were thinking, if I do that, I'm not going to see 50.
in all ways, yeah. So what I'm saying is, you're best known for having got away.
Having not been on all-star driving
there,
school.
I think so, yeah.
I was imagining it would be in like one of those things you see in like American films where they're going around cones.
That's
in a big car park.
Very much how I pictured it. And they do that for about an hour. And then they're like, right, on the road with you. And wow. I came away feeling that perhaps the best way to teach citizens to drive cars is not in front of TV cameras on an intensive course and already in real traffic.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You've got sort of lorries going by and all. It would suit a particular type of... But of course, inevitably, the other people had already had some driving lessons, or one of them had once taken a test and failed. So they...
Ah, so it wasn't brand. And you'd never done any of it?
I had never done any. I've done several of these sort of celeb formats where they're like, of course, the whole point is everyone is rubbish. And then you get there and everyone else prepped for months. Yeah, so actually you're the rubbish one.
And you had essentially a personal trainer next to you saying, push it.
At one point he said, the faster the car, the easier it is to control, which definitely is not true.
Wow.
Just a little bit of physics will tell you that's probably not
the case.
Otherwise, you could just go 200 miles an hour and it would be totally safe.
Yeah. They would encourage. Actually, there's speed limits, but it's for you have to go above this.
That's right. Yeah. Like in speed. Yeah.
Like in speed. Yeah, of course. Now, Mark, if I had to guess what you like at school, and this is normal school, not driving school.
Yes. Very different.
Which I do have to because it's the first format point of the show. What I've written is the following. One word to start with, prefect. Now, I do qualify this, which is, you're famous for organising things, big things. So that's kind of prefect-level behaviour. Obviously, you were good enough to have been head boy, but I think you would have been too modest to have stood for head boy. Now, I've said I reckon you're still in touch with upwards of three teachers. I reckon dinner ladies loved you. I think you spanned...
I've got to say, so far, this is really...
Is it?
This is on the money, pretty much. Yeah.
And my final thing is, I think you spanned both worlds of being a good student and still a fun pupil for the other pupils. For example, I think on the last day of school, when everyone messes up the school, a sort of prank, does a bunch of pranks, I can imagine that someone would have been maybe graffitiing or putting polyfiller in locks, and you'd have said something like, yes, it is fun to express ourselves, but shall we do it in a more respectful and legal manner?
Well, all of that is accurate, I'd say. I was a prefect for a start.
Yes. I knew it. But you've got prefect written all over you, and that's because you're still wearing the badge.
I literally do have a ring. Yeah, I've kept all the merch.
Yeah.
And it is also true that I was never really in the running for head boy. You applied to be a prefect, but you didn't apply for... the head, they just sort of picked...
Oh, they scouted you?
In the way you pick a captain of a football team or something. Someone was... And I was never...
Oh, really? Is that how it works? So you didn't get to do hustings?
There were no hustings. Presumably, the head and a bunch of teachers just picked... A bit like with the Oscars, there'd be buzz around a few people. And then they went for a bloke called Richard, who I don't think was... Now, this is a piece of peculiar trivia, and I'm not sure if this has a place on the podcast, really, but you might remember a few years ago, there was a bloke called... there was an internationally reported case of a bloke called Shreyan Dwani who went to South Africa and his wife was killed in a carjacking. And he was accused of the murder, but then not convicted. And there was a huge... Jeremy Vine made a documentary about it. It was a big... anyway, he was at school with me and he was the sort of bookie's favourite to be head boy.
Oh, wow.
But he was passed over for it, eventually also passed over for this, this alleged murder.
Yeah, and he's got previous.
It went to a bloke called Richard, and then there were something like four head prefects who were the sort of the vice captains who served under him.
The nominees.
And I was below that. So I was just a regular prefect, which meant you had a little bit of the kudos, but you didn't have to do very much.
And were these head prefects at your school, were they actually expected to do...
I think they had to do stuff like helping out with the younger kids, and they had a fair bit of actual admin. Whereas if you're at my level of prefect, it was more just... sort of honour, basically.
It's just a title for your personal statement.
I don't remember doing anything.
Don't have to worry.
I think it was very much about the personal statement.
Yeah.
I don't remember a single thing I did for the school, which I might be wrong, but...
Were there different titles? Was it just prefect, or was there like social secretary? Or
I can't remember
any others, but...
Yeah, I don't think we had that. I think that since I left school, schools have become a bit more into that kind of...
It's an American thing, right?
That it is.
We've kind of adopted.
And I wonder if that thing of messing up the school a bit on the last day is an American thing as well, because I watched Booksmart recently, and they basically just burned the school down.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible. And your estimate is true. If I had seen anyone, like, putting polyfill in the locks, I would have been the kid that was like, all right, we've all had a laugh. But in reality, I remember the last day being full of sort of hijinks, but not the sort of hijinks. I again, if you haven't seen Booksmart, they basically, it appears it's like a day where total anarchy. Has
yeah.
Someone's got a car in the playground. Things that, like, not just fire extinguishers, but things are being shaken and thrown. It's basically absolute carnage.
Yeah, it and was. There was some unacceptable stuff happened on my last day at school.
Did it?
So there there was.
Maybe there's more of a. You're younger than me. There might be more.
There
of
was polyfiller in the locks.
There you go.
Which is it's not fun.
No,
it doesn't make any sense.
It's not even a fun thing for you
also,
to do.
Also, because it was overnight, people had gone in the night before the last day of school to prep all this stuff.
Prepping.
Basically, the whole year was there the night before school.
This is amazing. Like,
but the building is locked. So the polyfiller in the locks, the idea was that, and then we can't get in any of the buildings. Right. Like, what if it's raining?
Yeah.
Then what do we do?
It seems really ill.
And also, it was
out.
The building of where our sixth form common room was, which is where the whole day was taking place the next day of all the, like, speeches and, like, the big presentations and all that. It was pointless.
So it was ill thought out.
Also, there was some graffiti, which was outside the PE block. There was a big, massive penis painted on the floor.
The most we did was just sign each other's shirts, as far as I remember. I was starting to feel like I went to school in the 1950s.
Well, everyone got kicked out. So when we got to school on the day, they were like, oh, this is an unprecedented level of unacceptable, which they said every year. So precedent it now, please.
Yeah, and now precedent.
Yeah, they were
so
like...
So it was a sort of tradition at your school that you already went into it knowing, oh, we're all going in the night before. It was a thing.
I think so, yeah. And it also, because of that, it snowballs because everyone wants to up the ante on the previous year and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, my
But it's not
was...
clever. No one does anything clever. So it's like, it's just... No, let's be the most horrible pricks we can be. And then we all got kicked out. So they were like, we need you to... The whole day's cancelled unless you own up. And I had a friend who was a twin, and one of the twins who wasn't really involved was really upset.
Amazing.
So the other one who was kind of involved, the twin, was like, okay, I'm not going to ruin his day. I'll go and sort this out. And just said, it was me. But it obviously... And then about 40 people then went, okay, fine, it was all of us. And it was a bit of a Spartacus type situation.
Amazing stuff.
And we thought, they can't kick out 40 of us. Well, they can. And they did.
On the last day?
Yeah, it was just like, you're all gone. See you later. And it was, I think about...
Expelled from school within hours of actually finishing your school career.
Not expelled, just told, you can't have this day and you have to leave. But that was their only punishment, really.
Yeah, because they haven't got much over you, have they? And so that's the whole point.
Yeah, exactly.
basically, your profiling of me was right, which is if I'd been in that situation, I would have sort of like enjoyed watching the graffiti and stuff take place, but I would have been very uneasy about the direction things were heading in.
I took a similar role. I kind of tried to talk someone out of the polyfiller situation, and I was not an authority on anything, so struggle.
I think I'd have used phrases like, think of the long-term consequences.
Yeah. Yeah, those don't go down well with the people who've got the polyfiller.
You're not seen as being fun at a party. The word consequences almost never comes out in these situations.
Were you liked, do you think?
Well, I think like most people, I have a memory of not being very popular at school, but I say most people that I
most people you know now,
but I don't think it was an extreme problem. I think I just sort of kept myself to myself to quite. I had a couple of friends and I didn't really venture beyond that, so I think I was selectively liked. People, you'll have had this because I think every comedian has, people tend to assume that you were the sort of the class joker. And like interviewers will always say, so were you the funny one at school? But and I don't remember being that person at all. We had a specific person that was that guy, in fact, a bloke called Paul, whose entire thing in life was just to wind up teachers. And I'd almost bet that he works in the insurance or...
Yeah.
I tend to find comedians and people that, you know, didn't have that outlet in our young days and were now compensating. And the people that were the class comedian have got that out of their system.
Right.
Now they're hedge fund managers or something.
And also they were just the ones who were doing it for a laugh. They're not the ones who need it. Like
no,
that.
Exactly.
We're the ones who go, oh God, I've got to prove something to someone. Because I was, the whole, were you a class clown? It's like, no, I was quiet.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I was stockpiling neuroses that would eventually come out in my life.
And also just like, and still am quiet except for 1 hour a day.
Precisely, yeah. The idea that comedians are like fun people to hang out with in everyday life is it's incredible that we get away with that.
I mean, it's
popular delusion.
To be honest, when you think about that, it's absolutely insane that podcasts exist.
It really is. Yeah.
Almost all podcasts are two comedians having a conversation.
Yeah, podcasts rest on the idea that people at home think, I'd love to just hang out with comedians and listen to their conversation. But it's, the longer we can preserve that idea, the better for our careers, obviously.
Absolutely.
But it's a dangerous idea. Whereas the bloke, Paul, as class clowns go, he was pretty good. His thing was just to ask questions which appeared innocent but were just totally irrelevant to the matter in hand. And I remember once a teacher briefing us on exam rules, and it was like, you can't have a phone. Well, we didn't have phones even, I don't think, but you know, you can't have any notes, all this usual stuff. And he put his hand up and said, you haven't said anything about apples. What happens if we're halfway through and I fancy an apple? And this examiner bloke was just thrown into a fury by...
I can imagine that, smashing it.
Absolutely stupid question. Well, yeah, the class, we were just delighted.
Obviously, the class loved that.
It was a legit question to ask, but it was also totally stupid.
Yeah.
Of course, the guy was just like, what? You can't have an apple. It's an exam. You you can have an apple after it. Even the fact that you had to keep repeating the word apple was a sort of victory. So that was what Paul was like. He just wanted to make teachers say shit.
Dignifying that with a response as an examiner
exactly.
is pathetic. Have the authority to say, obviously I'm not answering that stupid question.
Occasionally someone would do that, but he had a way of asking questions which appeared on the level.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he was almost a genius at it. But again, I bet none of those skills were transferable to now.
No,
he's
of course
got the most
not.
Boring.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him since school, I don't think, but I bet he's doing something.
I wonder what he's like in an office, though, with his boss saying, what if during this meeting I fancy a banana?
What if a dinosaur comes in?
Yeah.
There was a story that a teacher had been so wound up by this guy, Paul, that he jumped out of a second story window, jumped out of a classroom window. And that was not just...
Those stories...
I was going to say, it was like not just accepted, it was part of like the gospel of school. Everybody knew that. But then, as you get older, it turns out every school has some sort of archetypal tale of a teacher jumping out of it or something
it's
like
every
that.
Every school, now so you said that. I've every school has jumped out of the second story window, jumped out of the top floor of the English block, jumped out of whatever, second story window, onto the wood chips.
So looking back, that was one of my first experiences of the urban myth. I think it was just a thing which was thought to have happened in one school once in history.
Everyone's got that second story window jumped out. No one's ever done that.
No, I think I told the story at university and everyone was like, oh yeah, that happened in my school as well. And we started to realise we'd all been sold an ancient myth. Yeah.
How is that the best thing we can come up with? Is it because at schools there is only two stories to any building, really?
Yeah, and I think perhaps because it was like a survivable, you could almost believe a teacher would go crazy enough to do that, I suppose. So it had the ring of truth about it, but also as soon as you start interrogating it,
we never got the teacher did it. It was always just different students did it when they were being kept behind and they just went, right, I'm out. I never had a teacher doing it. That is the step.
It must be something to do with the fact that when you're at school, you do experience it as a sort of captivity. You're constantly gazing out the window thinking, I wish I was out here. So there is this collective fantasy of just jumping out of the window, which has gone from fantasy into an actual...
I mean, maybe that is a creative outlet for people at school, which is what this podcast is all about, is just lying about. It's like you're making up stories. You're not writing them down, but you're just making up stories of, Mr. Deacon jumped out of the window.
Yeah.
And then trying to tell this story like a campfire anecdote.
Basically, because what else have you got? You're listening to stuff about physics or something that you don't understand. Yeah. Naturally, you start to mythologize the experience. Yeah.
And come up with all the... It must be it. So you have brought some stuff that you wrote, but were you writing stuff... I know this is... You told me this is from when you were quite young.
Yeah.
When you're in secondary school, at the age we're talking about now, were you doing any creative writing then?
I was already into writing and stuff, And I had... My mum had what was then known as a word processor, although no one has said that for 20 years. Or I suppose you'd say it about piece of software, but I can remember when word processor was an actual name for a computer, basically.
Right.
And she was a secretary... So I used to sometimes borrow her thing, and the novelty of writing a story and printing it out in those days felt incredible. First time I ever did that, I think my dad took it into work with him and photocopied it. And again, seeing your work in sort of three or four copies like that was absolutely mind-blowing. And that is very early on. So I think I was basically...
Why was he making copies?
Looking back, I'm not sure. Presumably he was selling them or hoarding them. My parents have hoarded quite a lot of...
Oh, have they?
Which is what... podcast is about.
Yeah.
So perhaps I think he just wanted to show, he wanted me to have the novelty. I remember one time he worked in the school, my dad, so I suppose, he worked at the school I was at. That's one of the reasons why I was quite well behaved at school, because if your parent is in the staff
watchful
room,
eye of
changes
your father.
The relationship.
What did he do at the school?
He was a chemistry teacher. And
did he teach you?
Luckily, he never taught me directly.
Was that luck?
Well, I think so, because he was a good teacher, I think, and he luckily was quite popular, because I can't imagine a worse existence for a kid than...
Yeah.
But there was a girl in our year whose mum was an unpopular teacher. People were always sort of doing impressions of her and stuff, and I don't know how she got through that 7 years, quite
absolute
honestly.
Absolute agony,
whereas
I know those kids.
My old man was all right, no one seemed to have a problem with him, but there would be moments where I think they deliberately kept me out of his chemistry set, but because of some feeling that it would... And they were right, it would have been... weird as hell, I think. I also wasn't really good at chemistry. But sometimes your teacher would be off ill and then a random teacher would cover the class. And two or three times it happened that my dad walked in and, of course, everyone swivels to look at you and your father-son relationship is played out in front of your mates for a while. So I used to, much as I liked him and I felt like other people liked him, I used to try and minimise moments, because there were all these minefields, like, do I call him Mr. Watson or Sir? You can't call him Dad in front
of
the class.
I guess the good thing is if you do slip up and accidentally call the teacher Dad, you're fine.
It's the one time when that is not a career-ending mistake.
No one can go, he's called the teacher dad. He goes, he's just...
That's another great school thing, isn't it? The moment someone calls the teacher mum, like, is immortalised, basically.
Of course.
You never come back from that.
But it's weird, isn't it? Because it's something that I'd say 50% of the school go through at some point in their life.
Yeah.
But as soon as someone else does it, the heat's off.
You just needed to be popular at the time you did it, basically.
Yeah.
Like with so many things at school, it was fine if you had a group of people around you that could spin it for you.
Yeah.
But if you were going through a phase of unpopularity and then you slipped up like that, it could be a whole term written off. Yeah.
God, but why is it such a big deal?
Yeah, I suppose, again, it's something to do with that thing of everything's a big deal at school because you're so desperate for distraction.
Yeah, you have to cling to any kind of event.
Any storyline that comes up like that, you can be looking back on it for weeks just because you're desperate for a thing.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is part of what some bullying is, looking back. Like, I remember... I wasn't much of a sort of bully victim, but occasionally I would get beaten up in the way that certainly any boy that's ever been at school was once. I remember one time this bloke, we had to play rugby, and this bloke just took he took our uniforms away, like dumped them in a puddle, took my mate's bag, knocked us both over, kicked us for a bit. And like a couple of years later, when it was all fine, I asked him, why did you do it? What happened? And he was just like, I had nothing to do. I just didn't know what to do with myself. Like, right.
Must
have been other things you could have done instead of that, though.
Yeah,
this
but
before
that's
before phones, of course.
But that maybe, you know what?
Maybe
I know we've got cyberbullying now, but maybe Snapchat has actually stopped people getting their bags dumped in puddles.
I do wonder whether if we'd had apps in those days, there would have been quite as many heads going down toilets. Yeah.
But now it's just, memes. It's hurtful memes now.
Now you just psychologically destroy your classmates. Yeah,
yeah, so I mean, it goes much deeper.
It's
now.
Definitely worse.
Do you want a wet bag or do you want to have 16 years of therapy?
No, I'm definitely happy I got out of school in the late 90s. Well,
yeah.
It was still sort of analog bullying. Yeah, at least you knew the rules. You might have your head smashed into a door or something, but once you were home, you probably were fine.
You were fine, yeah.
You weren't logging
on. Get on the word processor, write about your feelings.
Get the word processor, smash out the story, yeah. Shows you the sort of different generations of comics.
Absolutely.
Like my, in inverted commas, early work literally is books that I wrote on paper and my dad stapled together for me.
And what are they? They're full books?
I used to... Yeah, they're basically not... Well, there's a couple of things that are magazines. This is called The Cricket Match, for example, by Mark Watson. And a later hand has written late 85, as in 1985, on it. I definitely did.
Oh, it's not you.
I can't have written it's late 85.
That must be. That's the sort of thing a teacher would do.
It's
right?
been archived
that
by
must
someone.
Be your dad.
At some point.
A teacher likes you to date things, and you obviously hadn't.
That's right. Yeah, and so I've done that obviously. And
so late eight. How old were you then?
So I'm five. So this is early precocious stuff.
Yeah,
precocious is the word, I think. Looking back, I probably had produced more novels at the age of six or seven than a lot of people have at that stage.
Didn't you write an actual novel in your early 20s? Your first novel was, you were really young then, right?
I was 23, yeah. I was a fast starter, I suppose. I did that. That was basically what I did immediately after coming out of university. And I suppose the seeds were sown here, because if I thought it was normal to publish novels at five, then...
But actually at 23, you're lagging behind, really.
Exactly. And I think I know why I had that idea. It's because there was a set of stories called The Garden Gang that I had, where it was like Mark Marrow is the one I remember because of the name, or Percy P. Anyway, characters that were all vegetables. And those had been written by some like prodigy 11-year-old whose face and name were on all over these, and goodness knows where that person is now. She was a girl, I remember. So I remember she was my sort of Greta Thunberg. She was my young idol. I was like, right, I had the idea that it was a reasonable expectation that by 11 you would have like a major body of work behind you just because of this girl.
God, the pressure that would have been on you.
Enormous. But as you can see, I rose to the pressure.
You clearly did. You got three. More than three. You've got loads of books.
A couple of these just newspapers. I had a newspaper called The Daily Blah for a bit. And this is, by now I'm seven by the look of it.
I had a newspaper. Daily Blah. I ran a newspaper for a while.
It's like Citizen Kane, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I ran a couple of papers.
I had a newspaper.
But my heart was
seven.
My heart was in the novels more, I think. This cricket one is, so I'm five, and it's written on that paper you used to get with like school lined paper, but I've written the wrong way, so it's kind of across.
The lines are going vertically. You've written across the vertical lines.
Strange.
So it clearly, what you're saying is you think outside the box. from an early age.
Yeah,
that's
I was interested in experimenting with form. Yeah, that's just who I was. Yeah,
I mean, really though, in reality, it's just because it makes a perfect A5 book if you fold that in half, right?
Presumably so.
That's
yeah,
what's happened?
I think my dad must have done a lot of the formatting. Yeah.
Let's have a look at the front cover.
So the front cover is the cricket match by Mark Watson, and there's a picture of a sort of a cricket. The cricketer's got a recognisable one of those V jumpers with a V on, which
people
now wear as fashion. But in those days, cricketers actually did dress like that.
Done the very classic 5-year-old's way of drawing hands, which is essentially a circle with a bunch of sort of sausages coming out of it.
That's right, five fingers, but that's where the similarity to a real hand ends. Years later, I read that Walt Disney himself never put five fingers on a hand because it looked like too many. And there was a whole archetype of cartoon characters. And I suppose The Simpsons, actually. Like a lot of the most loved ones because actual cartoon characters are allowed... Like, five fingers is basically quite impractical, And then the trouble with some of these works is I was obsessed with sport, as I suppose I still am. So the book is quite heavy on just the details of this. It's about me being picked to play... The first page says, I was going to play for England v Australia... in a one-day cricket test match. So it's not like, for a person so young, it's quite a mundane... Well, I suppose it's not a mundane dream. I still haven't played in the Ashes or a one-day or anything. Not representing... But it's an odd fantasy.
And can I just say, if you had, I certainly wouldn't have opened by saying you're best known for All-Star Driving.
So. No, I think it would be an elephant in the room if I played cricket at any sort of like international level, I think.
Yeah. I'm finding a way to bring that up.
He was also part of the successful 2005 Ashes campaign.
And so is this, when you were a kid, did you, your priority, I know no one dreams of being a comedian when they're five. Did you want to be a cricketer or other sports?
I was already obsessed with football, cricket and basically all sports. But I think I already knew that I was not going to make the great, even at that age. I think I had an instinct for, because I remember a lot of my earliest fantasies were about being a commentator or a sports broadcaster some way.
I mean, can I just say, I did say, hello, would go for head boy, but would have been too modest to have gone for it. At five, you got the modesty to go, I probably won't play, but I could commentate.
I remember...
That is some of that classic Mark Watson
it's
modesty.
It's amazing. It's almost too on-brand, isn't it?
It's so on-brand. It's embarrassing. At five, but you thought you'd commentate instead of playing.
It is true. I remember being in the playground about age 7 or 8, and all the boys were like, I'm Ian Rush, I'm John Barnes. And so it was all about that 80s Liverpool team. And all of them believed they were going to be pro footballers in the way that my 10-year-old does. And I remember... And again, I don't know if this is
you were saying
modesty.
I'm Motti.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm Guy Mowbray.
All those kids in the playground who dream of being Guy Mowbray.
If I'm not even him. I'm one of the people that does the sort of links by the side. By pitch side.
Sure.
I'm a pitch side reporter.
Yeah. Chappers, Mark Chappers.
I'm Chappers. I'm not sure if it was modesty or just more sort of like fatalism, like gloom. I was quite a gloomy. I think I basically remember looking around and thinking, I'd be surprised if any of these guys are actually going to be professionals, and I'm definitely not even the best in this game, so right. I had an unusual level of perspective, but I think it came from just pessimism. I do remember having that realization quite early. There was a bloke called Rob Day, I think it was, who was amazing footballer in the playground, and everyone assumed he was going to play for Liverpool. And I remember being about 9 or 10 one day, just thinking, we had a school game and we got absolutely thumped by someone. That's that moment where you think, hang on, this school are much, all their players are much better than us, and they're probably also not going to... I had this with my son recently. He was 10. He played in a school five-a-side tournament with a group format, and they rinsed the group, won every game, and you could see all the kids thinking, we're all the future. We will all play for Man City in the future. We're much better than we thought we were. And then in the knockouts, they met a far better funded school and got absolutely caned. And I could see my son going through that same psychological process with, hang on. Loads of people are good at football.
Yeah. That's great. So you get the outside perspective of another school come in and you realise you're living in a bubble.
Yeah, and then that school in turn doesn't win the tournament and you start to, the size of your task starts
tell you
to
what,
become obvious to you. Yeah.
Getting through the group stage and then being terrible in the knockouts, I mean, you could play for England. I mean, it's not that far away from historically what we've grown up
I did basically
England.
Say to him, this is how football works, so this is absolutely fine. Yeah.
Someone's got to be that team.
You'd be massively overachieving if you'd gone all the way.
Yeah, exactly.
All you did wrong was get thrashed in the quarterfinals rather than a heartbreaking penalty shootout exit. But basically, your course is set.
Did your son want to be a footballer before that happened?
Yeah, but I think only in the way that most
literally everyone
kids
does.
Do, that like football. Yeah. Which is, I think he probably... And of course, there are quite a lot of books, like actual books, where kids do live out their dreams like that. So, you know, kids do grow up with a disproportionate idea of how likely they are to be either an astronaut or a footballer or to discover an underwater kingdom or something. quite a lot of your duties as a parent is having to say to them, I know that happened in that book, but it might not happen.
Yeah.
My kid's got a book written by Theo Walcott. You know, some occasionally footballers write...
A children's book. Oh, right.
Called TJ and the Penalty or something like that. And it is a sort of semi-autobiographical work by Walcott about a kid becoming a footballer, which, again, is all great because it's a good way of getting kids to read. But my son has read so many novels where a kid that's good at football ends up playing for England.
Maybe there's a market for realistic kids' book dreams.
Someone should write, where the kid gets as far as a trial for Grimsby Town, doesn't quite make it, and then last time you see him, he's working in a supermarket. Yeah. That is a great idea for
and
a
then he was a barman.
A set of anti-kids books, basically.
Paul was the class clown at school. Everyone loved him. Now he's in insurance.
That would be amazing.
And he doesn't need it. He doesn't need to be funny anymore.
It's time we had a set of kids books that were all about how you quite likely can't achieve your dreams.
Realistic kids books.
Keep believing as much as you want, but you won't get there.
You've got a relationship with publishers. You could do this. All comedians eventually write a kids book.
Yeah, so I might as well submit to that. Mine is going to be a set of corrective kids' books about how a kid that goes to magic school looks like he's going to be a great wizard, but it just doesn't really work out.
Doesn't fulfill his potential, has to get a normal job, ends up getting on the open mic circuit, does some stand-up, and in 10 years later writes a kids' book. There you go. Yeah. It all comes back on itself.
Quite funny. I was reading the Harry Potter books fairly recently to my son, and there's so much hype around Harry. Like, this is the greatest wizard that's ever... We've been waiting for this guy. And I do remember thinking, this is a lot of pressure, and...
Yeah.
You long for an alternative version where Potter is just ultimately quite a mediocre wizard.
Yeah, maybe there should be a spin-off series about one of the other wizards at Hogwarts who's just sort of fine, that we don't even know.
Presumably in the realms of fanfic, people have written
books
about all the classmates of Harry have been covered and stuff.
If we do this podcast long enough, I'm sure we'll hear some of that fanfiction. One of our guests eventually, if we get through everyone, is going to have written fanfiction about James at Hogwarts.
For a second, I thought you meant the Manc band, James.
To be fair, Lolly had a phobia came on and read fan fiction about Everwood, which I'm sure you've never heard of.
No, I don't think so.
An American teen drama. So, and I allowed that to happen. So
it's interesting to me. I've heard a couple of episodes, and it does. I don't know if I'm the oldest person you've had on yet, but I'm 40, and you've got most of your guests. It is more like fanfics or stuff that's hoiked off the internet.
Sure.
It makes me feel very strange to look at these books look like ancient documents.
We have moved on to some old people, but they've not yet been broadcast.
Fine, I'm glad to hear that, because it does
they will have been by this time. So just look back on the last couple of weeks and you'll see who I'm talking about.
That's good, yeah. People that made silent movies when they were kids.
So come on, can we hear a little bit of this cricket book?
Yeah, so again, it is...
I don't mind if it's densely cricket-based.
Well, it's fairly... For example...
I don't know if you heard the Tom Rosenthal episode, but
I haven't heard his one yet. Did he also have...
He had recordings of raps he made for his cricket team. And it's not only is it about cricket, it's about specifically Cobham Green cricket.
Amazing stuff.
Whatever it's called.
In that case, I feel like I've got away lightly.
Yeah.
At least I've never attempted rap in my young days.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think we had rap in 1985. for example, I whacked the next one, but an Australian rushed over. I thought it would be run out. But on his way, the man from Australia bumped into me. So I got one run and luckily avoided being run out. So it's fairly kind of prosaic stuff, really.
The man from Australia. I love that. The man from Australia, not my opponent.
No, the man from Australia. I think I was trying to find different ways
of saying Australian, yeah.
My next ball went up in the air, but someone dropped it. So it was a 4. England were 11 for no wicket. And then, I haven't looked at this until today, but another example of my fairly sort of unspectacular fantasies. I've got myself getting out here. When I was out, England had 63 for 1, then Gooch hit a 4. So,
you are playing in the era of the pros at the time?
Yeah, I'm playing.
So you're imagining yourself, you're a 5 when you wrote this, you're imagining yourself as a 20-something.
I've put myself into the current England team. But I think most people would have themselves making a double century or something, but I've allowed myself to throw my wicket away.
63.
Yeah, respectable opening stand.
Very respectable, but, as I say, completely modest.
But
what we'd come to expect from a Mark Watson novel.
Yeah, and in fact, looking down in the pages, I've got England all out for 179. Great score.
Maybe you're not so modest then, because you get a high percentage of those runs yourself.
The team fell apart after I was out, actually. Yeah. So I suppose I've sort of given myself a backhanded compliment. Yeah. And actually looking through now, I also catch someone out. And you quite often see this when kids write a book. It's fair to say the ending is a bit rushed. It says, Australia's first ball went for 4, but I dove down and caught it. So I'm the hero. And then that's page 8. And then page 9 is the last page. It says, every other batsman got 6. So Australia finished with 54, England 1. And that's it. And presumably I had to have tea at that point or I think if there's a pattern to my early work.
I must say that specifically as an ending is insane and inconceivable. Every other batsman got 6.
Yeah, I'm surprised the narrator doesn't remark on how incredible that is. I'm not sure there's ever been a cricket match where everyone got the exact same
everyone
score.
Everyone gets 6.
Quite a lot of these early
very low scoring cricket match that.
But yeah, I think to
was it 179 to 54?
Get Australia out for 54 is some effort, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, and I suppose it anticipates that game a few years ago where Stuart Broad almost did do that.
Yeah.
But a lot of my books of the period do bear the marks of me having had to go to bed or something and being determined to finish it, because you have to say that's quite abrupt, really.
Is this why you now actively try and rally against that by doing shows that last 24 and 48 hours.
I must be purging this anger at the fact that
no one's going to tell me when to finish.
I'm not finishing on page 9 now, man. maybe these 24 hour plus shows are just a kind of delayed revenge against everyone that ever put constraints on my time. Yeah.
When you're writing a book now, do you find yourself rushing the ending?
Well, yeah. But anyway, he died in the end.
Yeah, yeah. Spoiler alert for every single one of Mark's books. Australia gets 6 each and everyone dies.
There was a book one of the novels that I wrote where it does end with quite an abrupt, I suppose it's a spoiler, but with the protagonist getting hit by a car, and that's the end of it. And obviously it was a sort of conscious choice, but it felt to me like the best way to... It's a sort of ending people either like or don't. Mm. But someone did tweet me going, enjoyed your book, a bit disappointed with the ending. It felt like you just ran out of time a bit. And I was like, mate, you don't run out of... It's not an exam. You don't write a book under test conditions in 3 hours. I deliberately ended it like that. I didn't just think, oh, shit, I'm going to have to hand this in now.
Yeah, you got a publisher on your back.
I'd love it if writing a book did involve just being locked in a room with a publisher and they're just saying, looking at their watch, going, well, that's it now.
Pencils down.
And finish the sentence you're on, please.
And then he got hit by a car. That's how the first series of Skins ends.
Yeah, I mean,
he gets hit by, just randomly out of nowhere, gets hit by a bus.
But again,
really irrelevant to the story.
Presumably they will have made that decision in a group. The writer didn't just go, oh, I've got to go for tea with Bill Nash.
Yeah, exactly. May I hear something from the Daily Blah,
yes,
if you don't mind? What were the sort of scoops in those times?
The scoop.
So front cover.
The front cover says Nepal mission. There's a picture of some mountains.
I mean, that is some of the most precocious stuff I've ever
seen. It's not. It's absolutely
life.
Not. So
at seven.
Just turned 7 at this point.
And you're writing about Nepal.
Nepal mission. And it says, so presumably these are friends of my parents who are going off to Nepal. I don't remember any of this at all. And I've reported it by saying Nepal mission. Emma and David Wilson today said 2-year goodbyes to the Watsons. Their 2-year journey to Nepal kicks off at 4 p.m. tomorrow. I don't know... They can't have said we're off at 4 p.m. And that's it.
They would have done. It's the sort of detail you say.
I suppose it is,
actually. Flight at 4.
I've spelled there incorrectly.
I think you can be forgiven for that, given that this is a newspaper. I mean, to be fair, it's quite interesting this is front page news.
Well, it is. But then actually, look at some of the other stuff. It's not that surprising. One of the things that I find interesting looking back at this is I've got quite a big collection of football programmes now, and that began then. I always loved, would always get a programme. People would bring me programmes back. And... obviously, they were full of adverts and stuff, as well as team information stuff. And so I grew up thinking adverts were, you know, adult and impressive things. So all the newspapers and things that I made in this period have imaginary adverts in. So on page 3 of my newspaper, for example, need a roof done. And then there's a picture of a house. And it says, and then Watson Pub, the best beer. And I think this has got to be... in impersonation of the football programmes I'd seen, where there was always... In those days, it was always ads for, like, fags and...
Quite adult things. Need a roof done. Who's thinking about that?
Astonishing. I've no idea where I got
that. Is that the whole advert?
That's the whole
idea. With a picture of a roof.
Need a roof done, and it says dial 3677073, which is a made up number. And then there's
It's one of those 3-6 numbers, is it? That's how they get you.
That's right.
Premium rates.
Yeah, yeah.
One of those 3-6.
Yeah, this is how I ultimately funded myself through university. Ran a series of supposed helplines. But on the page 1, and this is something for you as a Spurs fan, it says today at White Hart Lane, second leg, Milk Cup semi, Arsenal v Spurs. And I've done sort of... That must have been a real game that was on. So the newspaper is a strange mixture of...
Milk Cup semi-final, Arsenal v Spurs.
What is now the Carabao Cup.
In 80... That would have been 87.
87, and I think Arsenal went on to beat Liverpool in the final. But I did this quite often. Adverts for real, as if somehow I could help you to watch the match, even though... And on the next page, you could win a brand new car or a lorry, plus £1 million. And there's... various pictures of cars and lorries here, but I've no idea how I had these to give away. I don't remember.
It's one of the most generous competition prizes I've ever seen.
£1 million and a lorry, yeah.
And a lorry. I don't know. You need someone to put the cash.
No idea who was bankrolling this. Presumably my dad just gave me millions of pounds to publish this newspaper. Because he was the only reader, obviously, of the...
That's the odd thing.
Well, was he copying these as well and distributing them?
Maybe.
Staff room at the school.
Maybe I had a readership of several thousand.
Yeah,
it's odd. It's quite sort of touching for me to think that my dad would...
The idea of winning £1 million and a lorry, to me, is like, if you win, they drive a lorry full of cash to your house and just give you the keys.
Presumably that's how we did it. Again, I don't remember these. It's interesting because, obviously, my dad was the only person, maybe my mum, but I think largely my dad was the only reader of these. So he would staple them together and then I would deliver it to him. And then he would read things like, in this case, a story about his own friends going to Nepal, which he presumably wasn't front page scoop for him. Because he had the conversation with them that I was reporting on. So he must have feigned surprise at some of these news stories because I only ever got them from hearing him talk about stuff.
I suppose he was the source of a lot of these stories though, right? Your parents were the source. So they're reading back going, they're almost like an editor.
Yeah.
Looking back going, correct, you're the journalist.
Presumably so, yeah. Occasionally it would be, I've got another one here. Sometimes there'd be a real life. No, a lot of the rest of these are just works of fiction actually. But sometimes I did put real stuff on. I've got one from slightly older when I was 9 with a front page about the Hillsborough disaster. And I mean, I don't think I was the one that broke that story looking back. I'm pretty sure that's just something I'd heard about. And
but again, we needed your perspective.
I'd be very surprised if that was how my dad learned about that as well. I don't think I was
first. Have you heard this, darling?
Yeah, I don't.
Our son's on the front line of this absolutely historic moment.
I'm not sure I ever actually broke a story in the traditional sense, because as you say, most of my sources were also the readers, which is...
I must say, the Daily Blah is the only paper I can think of covering your parents' friend's trip to Nepal.
I don't think...
To be fair, you did have the scoop on that.
I don't remember getting a lot of coverage. The fact that I don't know who Emma and David Wilson... I'll be surprised if my parents even... I don't remember who that people is. Called Emma and David ever being referred to when I was growing up, so I do wonder if there's a...
Maybe it's made up.
I mean, it's possible. It's such a very... It's a weirdly specific thing to make up, but as we've seen, I was into making up weirdly specific stuff. Later on in this newspaper, there's an advert for a new single by my church. It says, new single by Good Shepherd Kindergarten, We Are the Church. And that is based on We Are the World, which had recently come out. But this single didn't exist. I just imagined that my Sunday school had released a single.
A cover.
And this is changed world to church. There's a...
Most of this is adverts.
A lot of the newspapers that I wrote in those days were just adverts for imaginary products. Yeah. So in a way, I was always likely to become a comedian, I suppose, spin a career out of total bullshit.
Nonsense. That's amazing. When I was a kid, I remember everyone being asked, when we were about 10, everyone being asked what they think they'll do when they're older. And everyone, obviously at 10, is fiercely ambitious and says things like footballer or fireman and stuff like that. And I knew that I wanted to be... like an actor or like a kind of a comedian, comedy type thing. But I knew that was unrealistic.
Yeah.
So I literally said, they said, what do you want? I said, I'd probably just go into advertising.
That's
about 10 years
That's
old.
Great.
Like, well, there's transferable skills from like wanting to be a comedian into advertising, as you've proven.
Fun to think of a teacher looking at a 10-year-old.
And going, good God.
Advertising, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, what a bleak outlook on life.
Yeah, I think quite a lot of comedians, because there was no established career path of stand-up comedy when we were at school, that quite a lot of us had some sort of yearning for what this job would end up being, but you couldn't really articulate.
Well,
the best you could do was like actor or something.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the same thing at all.
One of the problems with it was there was not really any young comedians on TV at the time.
No, that's the thing.
So everyone was about 40 who was like a famous TV comedian.
Oh, same for me, for sure.
So it was sort of like, well, obviously you have to wait. Obviously you start, because also you assume... Oh, he's just started telling jokes now, and now he is on television.
As people still do assume, they see Ramesh for the first time, and they're like, oh, that guy that began last week is quite good, actually, yeah. But it's true, I don't remember seeing any comedians that... Also, I assume there were only about 6 comedians in existence, like Victoria Wood, Lenny Henry, just those guys.
Yeah.
So, the idea of being a comedian... So I think I'd probably had some sort of creative... wanted to be some sort of creator... And I knew people definitely wrote books. That girl had done it that was still at school.
Right.
So basically that...
You knew there was an 11-year-old who could write out there.
I think so,
that's
yeah.
That's why you did this.
I think so.
Could we hear another piece of fiction?
Yeah, so I had a friend called Heather. This is a real-life friend, but she lived in Canada, which is something you say if you've got an imaginary friend. Because she's in Canada. But I actually did have a friend in Canada.
She went to another school in Canada.
Because my parents had briefly been to... We lived in Canada for a year when I was a kid. So I had this... exotic sort of pen pal called Heather, and quite a lot of my stories are adventures, the so-called Mark and Heather stories. So this, for example, this is called Back in Time, and me and Heather are on the cover, It says book number 37, and I'm not sure if that was a flight of fancy or if I had written 37 of these. Either is possible.
From what we've said today, it is quite feasible that you wrote 37 books, Adventures of Mark and Heather.
I got that convention from things like the Hardy Boys, and there'd be these series I'd written where it would say book number 80 or Choose Your Own Adventure. They always had very high... So I think I might have been pastiching that, but I might well have written 37, to be fair. I'm grateful to my parents for saving these, but who knows how many they've had.
Would they really have saved a further 36 of these?
At some point, you want your asset back. I don't really blame
you. You just want one example, really. You don't need 30. And this is just that we don't know how high it goes.
No,
this could be in the middle.
I doubt this was the final one.
Yeah.
So in this one, me and Heather get a... Now, this is odd because when I wrote this, I was six. And as you've heard, in the cricket book, I am myself at six playing for England. Here, though, I've transported us into the future because me and Heather have got a time machine. And it says, "What now?" asked Heather, a lovely 23-year-old coming from Canada. So
a bit of exposition there.
I've set it in
very clunkily.
It feels a little bit on the nose, that, doesn't it? Yeah.
Pop that in a script and see if you get away with it.
And then this is a bit odd. "Press this button," said Mark, a good-looking 38-year-old from England.
That is very strange.
I've moved this into the future, but I've made myself 15 years older than her.
Yeah.
Not clear.
You were the same age, presumably, in real life.
We were the same age, and we still are the same age in real life.
I'm letting you get away with the good-looking bit without mentioning it.
No, strange that.
You sort of tried to move past that, didn't you?
I'm sort of charmed that my main aim in life was to become a 38-year-old, a good-looking 38-year-old one day.
Did you consider yourself a good-looking 38-year-old?
I'd say I've got a pretty generic look, pretty average looking, but I don't remember good looks ever having been an aspiration of mine. I'm surprised that that's how I characterised myself. And I don't know why I made myself so much older than Heather that it almost, if it was a real life relationship, there'd almost be questions asked.
Absolutely frowned upon, yeah. But you're good looking, so fair enough.
And this was the 80s, it was a different...
Maybe this explains it. Maybe that's why the character needs to be good looking, so that we believe that he could possibly hang out with the 3-year-old?
I suppose that's it. I suppose that's what I was thinking. She's 23. And so basically we get a time machine. We go first, again, on brand to the World Cup final. So the one that England won. England were playing West Germany. Mark leaped as Hurst scored. For England was his birthplace. So just getting the reader inside my head, helping them understand why it meant so much.
Oh, the writing style is wonderful.
England was his birthplace.
Was his birthplace.
And then we, I suppose we've all thought about what we would do with a time machine, but the way me and Heather use it is surprising. We go back to 1966 for the World Cup Fund, which at this point is only 20 years back, and then we go back to Adam and Eve. So nothing in between that. They got out and looked around. It was deserted apart from a man and a lady who had no clothing. "It's Adam and Eve," said Mark, fainting. Only Heather caught him. So actually, I'd rather make myself the hero. I've had Heather sort of rescue me here from... And then this is another example you see of... When you think that we've done six pages, we've already been to the 60s and then to the dawn of mankind. Yeah. It seems like there's so much more we could do.
Yeah.
Page 7 says, "Mark, when he came round, decided they should return the time machine to the BBC, and Heather agreed, so they did." And that's the end of that.
Oh, it's another one of those endings.
We didn't even get to a ninth page here, page 7. So having...
Returned to the BBC?
Oh, yeah.
Doctor Who?
I missed this out. No, there was a programme called Galloping Galaxies at that point, it seems. And the first page says, "Mark had bought a time machine from Galloping Galaxies, the TV show." And I can vaguely remember that, and I think they did have some sort of intergalactic time-travelling adventures. So the narrative is that I bought the time machine, presumably from the same source of money as this £1 million and lorry competition, bought the time machine, and then only used it to go back to watch one football match to see Adam and Eve, and then we decided it was probably time to...
There's not really any other events we need to do.
Again,
and if there are, they'll be covered in the Daily Blast, so we can just read about them there.
That's the thing, yeah. Again, it gives you an insight into someone with quite limited expectations of what he was capable of, that my character in this is like, we've had our fun, we've been around in the time machine a bit. Enough's enough.
Let's not push our luck vibe from Mark Watson as a child.
The Roman Empire? I don't know, that's too much.
Come on, we've had a day...
Yeah, it's been a hell of a day. I fainted when I saw Adam and Eve. I suppose...
How would you faint? You're the one who presumably chooses in a time machine where you go back to.
Yeah, I don't know why I was... Perhaps I'm just overwhelmed by the sense of how much time has passed and stuff like that. I reckon if I went back to the sort of the first day of humans now, I'd feel very odd.
I suppose you'd faint, even if you'd programmed it. The sense of occasion.
The occasion got to me, I think, as they say. I think, funnily enough, 35 years on, I sort of have a similar approach to time travel, I think, which is in these questions of, like, where would you go given a time machine? I can't help asking questions like, am I guaranteed safe passage back? Like, do I know exactly how it works? Can I program it? All this sort of stuff is why.
Will I faint? Will there be someone there to catch me who's 15 years younger than me?
Exactly. Will they have an entourage?
Yeah.
Definitely. I think I am quite literal minded. Any question like that where there is a fantasy dimension to it, I'm always like, can I check a few things here? Because, for example, I probably would go back and see the Romans or Middle Ages, maybe, because I've always loved medieval stuff. But I want to, I'm not going back to the time of Richard II, but then I get killed because everyone gets killed in those days. I want to know this stuff basically before I commit to time travel.
Yeah, and you can want to see, go to a safe bit of the past.
I want to be guaranteed
from a distance. And are you invisible? Are you in the world or what?
All of this stuff. Exactly. Yeah. What would you do with invisibility for a day question? Again, I'm like, can people see objects that I'm moving? I just like to know what the parameters of these superpowers are. And that's perhaps why I have never had a superhero movie made out of me. Because watch actual superhero movies,
I've got to say,
there's very rarely this sort of admin involved.
Well, once again, there's another gap in the market. You've got your realistic kids book, and you've got your realistic superhero movies.
Yeah,
a neurotic man who wants to know all the details before he accepts his powers.
Yeah, a man who will climb up the building, but he needs to be absolutely assured that he has enough energy to get all the way.
I'm not wasting my time going up halfway.
So this flying thing, does it wear off like a phone's battery? Or I don't want to get up there and I'm in trouble. Yeah,
and who cleans up these webs after I've shot them? I don't want to litter.
Yeah. Are you sure I'm invisible? Just people are still looking in my direction.
Right, Mark, it comes to the time where I have to score your work.
Oh, right, yeah.
Now, there's three categories I have to score it on. They are originality, pure teen horniness, and Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score. How close is it to your work now? What does it represent of who you went on?
Not going
to
do great on teen horniness here, although I did call Heather lovely looking or something like that.
Oh, I believe it was yourself.
I was as horny as I could be at the age of six.
Well, maybe this is why you're ending books so quickly. You're getting bored.
Yeah.
You've got stuff to do.
Yeah, got stuff to do. Got to explore my sexuality,
Originality. I've 4 out of 5. I've got to go 4 out of 5 for that.
I'm happy with that, yeah.
It's a very original way a cricket match would unfold. It's very original that you'd be writing these things. The Daily Blah is a nice nod to the nonsense of tabloid newspapers. You're writing articles about Nepal.
Yeah, I really zinged those guys back in the
day.
We still have a tabloid press.
It's like Mad Magazine. It's incredible that you're up to. In fact, no, 5. It's got to be 5.
Oh, amazing.
There's nothing unoriginal about what you were doing. Pure teen horniness, 0. There's no horniness in it, and I'd be uncomfortable giving you a point.
I'm sort of glad that there's no horniness, I think, given the situation.
It's maybe the most innocent thing that's been on this podcast so far.
I can imagine some people do score very high on
horniness. Yeah. It's usually me, actually.
Yeah.
I'm reading poems from when I'm 17, largely, so they're pretty horny stuff.
The poetry of a 17-year-old is very different from the time travel novel of a 5-year-old.
Exactly, absolutely.
Different genre.
Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose. How close is it to your work now? Does it show potential of a future star? I mean, it's absolutely identical. I mean,
it's quite clearly from the exact same writer.
The mind is represented so strongly. All of the neuroses, all of the concerns are identical. The modesty that we talked about earlier, it's all there. It's all in there.
It's weird looking back how much I recognise it as my own work.
Yeah.
I got in the cricket team, but I didn't play that well. Actually.
I wasn't that good. I got out. I did okay.
I got access to a time machine, did a bit of stuff with it, and then...
We potted about in the past.
Potted about. Didn't do anything stupid, though.
It didn't take any risks, really.
Probably bought a ticket to the World Cup final, even though I'd got there in a time machine, to be on the safe side. Don't want to get there and then locked out.
And I bet when you were at the World Cup final, you still thought, oh, can we do it?
Yeah.
You never know. No. You never know what could happen.
I think I've seen this, but I'm not completely...
I'm not 100% sure.
I'm sure I apologised to Adam and Eve for seeing them naked.
Exactly.
Well,
and you still fainted, even in your own fantasy. In your own fantasy, you couldn't handle seeing
it. The fantasy that I had chosen was nonetheless too much for me to process. Yeah,
exactly. So 5. So that's a 10 out of 15.
Yeah, I'll have
that. Very respectable score. Congratulations.
Even a bit of horniness would have given me a higher score, but what can you do?
Yeah, exactly. Now it comes to my turn to read you a poem from my back catalogue. Both of these are untitled. I found them on documents in called Personal Statement Stuff.
Yep.
So I'd written them at the bottom of all the listing all the things I was going to put on my personal statement, like how I, in the last 24 hours, had become a member of Amnesty International so I could write it on my statement, for example.
Yes, Amnesty always get a sudden swell applications
around
UCAS time.
Yeah. but I actually have 2. I didn't know they would be this appropriate. So you can choose which one you want. One of them is about time, and one of them is about the Garden of Eden.
Wow, that's incredible.
So that is
we should go for that, surely. Because,
with the Garden of Eden?
Yeah, because that is a delightful coincidence that both of us have produced early work about Genesis. Yeah.
Okay. And now I think it's from the perspective, potentially, of Eve.
Right. So you were already putting yourself in other people's minds, writing across.
I was really speaking on behalf of women.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay. You ready? Where is my Eden leading? Is this eternal feeling feeding my desire, cultivating my needs or rekindling my fire? Or is this Eden the disease? Escape from ease and dangle trees of lust above me as my soul just pleads. What's the cure? Where's the door? How much more can we endure? I'm abhorred. I'm bored. I'm lost. I'm trapped in heaven. Just, I've been banished to my mind, this room where all the walls are nails with thoughts attached. And if perchance I stumble across one, perhaps my mind can resurrect a feeling, an emotion which I'm dealing, a weaving, dreaming sense of believing that I've missed, since I picked, since I bit, since I could hardly resist. And for this, was it ever worth it? Now I'm worthless, just reworked and hurtless. Now my furthest level is turbulent and I'm reversing without purpose.
I mean, that's a very different take on the Garden of Eden. I suppose both of our narrators share a sense of dread or anxiety at the whole prospect of the Garden of Eden. And you're 17 writing that.
Yeah.
In its own way, that is as peculiar as me at 5 writing novels about cricket.
Absolutely baffling that.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I think the idea is, I mean, to be honest, I can't actually fathom quite how much this poem ties up everything we've talked about.
It's almost too convenient.
Not only is
it... People will have to trust us that this was not engineered
this way. It's not a scripted podcast.
We just both were at some point obsessed with the Garden of Eden.
It's insane. So it's about the Garden of Eden for a start. It's all about being banished because I ate and bit the apple.
Yeah.
As Paul would have asked, what happens if I want an apple?
Remarkable, yeah.
And it ends with the line, I'm reversing without purpose, as you did on Celebrity Driving
School. Not like I did, except, yeah. Yeah, this is it's incredible how much our lives and art have been intertwined with each other for people that have only met a handful of times. Did you ever, presumably you never performed this poetry, it was just written for yourself?
I imagine I wanted to perform it, but I never did.
It sounds a lot like... a poetry, you see someone doing a poetry slam.
It sounds like performance poetry. I've seen some of that and I've gone, oh, I'll do that.
I can rhyme a word with another word quite quickly.
But it makes no sense. Yeah, disease comes up a lot in my poems because it rhymes with a lot of things.
Yeah, it's handy, isn't it? Yeah, trees, bees.
Is this Eden my disease? I mean, what could that possibly mean?
I don't know, but it does have a musicality to it. They sound a bit like song lyrics that you might get. Yeah. I mean, it's quite impressive, but it does...
My favourite bit is, where's the cure... Where's the door? How much more can we endure?
A quadruple rhyme like that. You absolutely
love this stuff.
Yeah.
Where's the door? What mad thing to talk about when you're in a garden.
Yeah, I don't remember there being a door. If there'd been one, Adam and Eve would have just got out of that as quick as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite pretentious, I suppose. 17-year-old, that's what the height of your pretension.
It's exactly the level of pretentiousness that a 17-year-old poetry is all about. But it's ambitious. I don't think that much...
What makes you think it's ambitious?
Well, artistically, just choosing the sort of creation story, the Garden of Eden as your subject is as teen poetry goes. I've got to say,
it's not the first Garden of Eden poem I've read on this podcast.
Fair play.
For listeners, if you want to go back, this is part of a series. The first one was in the Rosemary Tafeo episode. Again, it talks about the price of my disease in the Garden of Eden.
Amazing stuff.
Disease.
So the idea of original sin was obviously quite present in your brain.
When you're 17. To me, anyway, and certainly to people I hung out with, 17 is the age where you become obsessed with being an atheist. If you are indeed an atheist, it's the age where you become obsessed with going, God's not real.
Yeah, you start to define yourself against popular stuff that's out there.
Yeah,
like religion.
Are you idiots believe in a magic man in the sky? Yeah, and think that you're amazing.
And of course, there are
one Ricky Gervais.
Tweet. Quite a few people out there that still are
talking about that,
of course. Yeah, some people never get past that.
Yeah.
No, you're right. I see. So you
get into Dawkins and stuff at that age and go like, yeah, you idiots. And then it's like, you know what? A step further. I'm writing it from the perspective of one of these fictional characters.
Yeah, I'm going to tear down the whole structure. Yeah.
That's what I thought would happen. I didn't have a mate, unfortunately, who said, I'll put that on the internet for you so the whole world
could
see it.
But if it had gone online, you would have expected organised religion to unravel fairly soon after that.
It would have been the end of it. Now people have changed. Putting it out in the world now, it's sort of fine.
Yeah, yeah.
People are sort of fine with all that stuff, but at the time,
At the time, it would have been earth shattering in much the same way the God delusion ultimately was. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and yeah, if I'd got a reputation for that, I'd now be doing tweets about not being able to take honey through customs. And
yes, I think we should all be grateful that you haven't followed Dawkins.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird because all of these atheist heroes you have when you're that age have basically gone insane.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the absence of religion, they filled the void with, in some cases, absolutely mad tweets about honey. Yeah. Recently, he was tweeting about how you could eat a baby, but he wouldn't do it himself or something like that.
Turns out, you need God.
Yeah.
Turns out that system of punishment based on heaven and hell is really what stops you
starting
madness.
To think that one day a week where we try to behave well is not the worst idea, actually. Yeah.
Well, there we go. Right, I now need you to score that poem. First category is originality out of 5.
I think I'll go to four because the...
Really? I think that's generous. But
well, I think the actual sort of maybe some of the rhymes and the stuff doesn't seem that original, but I have not heard a teen poem about the Garden of Eden before. So just for subject matter, I think, and for the daring of taking Eve's perspective, I think that's a kind of a bold leap. Yeah.
Sure. Pure teen horniness?
Well, there's not that much explicit horniness, but there's a fair bit of repressed emotion in there. I think I'd go three just for implied horniness. Yeah,
yeah, repressed emotion.
Plus, I know you were 17 when you wrote it. I don't know what I was like 17, so you can't really get less than five. But yeah,
repressed emotion is pretty much my middle name as a 17-year-old poet.
Yeah,
it's all in there. There's rage and all sorts of stuff running through all these things, frustration everywhere.
It's the sort of approach that your teacher might read and say something like, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then have a conversation in the staff room about whether you seemed all right.
Mickey Mouse Club, Ryan Gosling, Ryan Goose score.
Well, this is interesting because I've really only seen you do stand-up, and superficially, that I wouldn't say that that has a lot of resemblance to the other things I've seen you do on stage, except I suppose that...
You've not seen my Garden of Eden routine?
The old classic.
Yeah.
You know when you're Eve?
What's... Yeah.
But there is a sort of conjuring with words and stuff, which is not too dissimilar to a lot of your early stand-up. So just for the kind of tone, I think I might go three again. Like you can see, you've gone off in different directions since, but I feel like some of the seeds are there. There's quite a lot of wordplay and the rhythms are not unlike what you might do, I reckon, today.
Fair enough. That means I get a 10 as well.
Oh, that's nice, isn't
it? 10 out of 15. So it's so typical for something Mark Watson is doing. The podcast Mark Watson's on is it ends in a draw, even though he could have made himself win.
Annoyingly vanilla of me.
He could easily have made himself win.
It would have been so simple to give you 3 out of 5 in every category. And
he's chosen to make it a draw. Yeah. It's so on brand.
Amazing stuff.
We draw.
Everyone walks away happy.
But the message of the thing is we are both losers, whether we win or not.
Ironically, I've got two sisters, one of them really into sport and one's not. And the one that's not loves draws. Because of that thing of like, oh,
friendly,
that's nice, isn't it? No one loses, it's friendly. And when she does that in relation to sport, I'm absolutely infuriated by it. Obviously, like anyone that likes sport, what are you talking about? The exercise was not meant to be for everyone to be happy. And yet here now I've unconsciously engineered a draw just so that the podcast can have a nice close.
What I would say is the listeners to this podcast don't tend to be at home with their scarves supporting one of the guests or the host and going, God, no!
They're not
it's a last minute equaliser.
The result, no.
They just kind of go, whatever.
Enjoyed it, but I was gutted when the guest lost.
Yeah, exactly. In many ways, that's just sort of a format point that helps us separate it into sections.
Fair enough. I hope no one's...
Which you could argue is the same with wickets. Now, have you got a final piece that you would like to play us out with? And we will produce this up. We'll put sound effects in it. We'll put music under it. We're going to make it sound, especially as you wanted to whenever you were, six or seven?
See, this will work quite well with specific sound effects because this is another Mark and Heather book, another in this series.
And what number is this?
Me and that. This time I didn't put a number on it for some reason, but it's called Mark and Heather Visit the USA. I'm just looking to see whether we, again, are adults here or not. I don't think we are. I think here we are our current selves. Anyway.
Okay, cool. I'd love to hear it.
I don't know whether I wrote this before or after the time travel one. Mark and Heather wanted a holiday in the US of A. Mark was counting their money to see if they had enough to go. We have, he announced. We can afford to stay there for 1 week. Yippee, said Heather, making no hesitation to jump up and down, somersault, headstand in the air. Brackets, which is not all that easy since you have nowhere to put your head. And attempted to kiss Mark, only he scurried away, embarrassed. It was 08:45 hours. Aboard the plane, Mark and Heather looked out of the window and saw America coming nearer and nearer. Well, at least Heather tried to look out, but Mark was on the window side, so she knocked him over. Oops, she said, innocently. A little bit of back and forth between me and Heather there, bit of chemistry. They got out of the plane, at once surrounded by people seeking their autographs. This is a twist. Mark and Heather are famous, you know, it says in brackets. I didn't realise this, but somehow in this... Surprisingly, we still have had to save up to go to America for a week, but we have some form of celebrity in this particular future. But signing just a couple for Mark and Heather is awkward because they like to be on their own. So there you go, a much more explicit seam of desire in this book. Wow, said Heather. Look at the height of that building. Crikey, said Mark. That's C dot dot dot. Crikey, said Mark. And then, this is a poignant moment, that's the World Trade Center Tower, said Mark. Yes, just one of our moderate-sized buildings, joked a passing guide. So there you go. A little bit of a gag about America's extravagant architecture there. Oh, no, said Heather suddenly. We don't know any Americans. You're forgetting something, Heather, replied Mark. Said Heather. Mark, smiling, produced an American phrase book, which he always had with him. Oh, yeah, said Heather. Well, and again, by now, people will be used to these slightly bracing finales. Well, soon the week passed and I had to return. And that's something of an anticlimax there.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's, well, yeah, not, I mean, it really ticks all the boxes.
Not loads
ticks
of
all the boxes
there.
That I wanted. I do have a couple of things to mention. It's lovely to say this man, this character, Mark, always has an American phrasebook on him. Always.
But, yeah.
And this is a man who just said, "Kukriki."
That's right.
Maybe the least American phrase in history.
I hadn't delved into the phrasebook at that point. No, I feel like, again, the modern me would try and set up this plot point that I always have an American phrasebook with me earlier, because it does feel a little bit shoehorned in there.
Yeah. And the other thing is just that I would very much be looking forward, if I was around at the time when you wrote this, I would have very much been looking forward to the front page news in a Charles newspaper about the 1 week holiday that Mark and Heather are about to go on.
Uneventful holiday planned.
Yeah, in the Daily Chat or something like that. Wonderful. So you literally just, you got a phrase book, and then next thing you know, they have a holiday and they go home.
Well, the holiday consisted just of signing some autographs, looking at a building, and then being forced to return home. Yeah, disappointing. Home. The weird thing is I'm still sort of, again, obliquely in touch with Heather. Like, I have her on Facebook. I never really go on Facebook, but I do have the... And I don't think we've ever discussed that we were the heroes of this franchise.
Did she read these?
I don't imagine she ever did.
Well, she sent these.
Because she lived in another country. I don't think she... ever was in on it, to be honest. No, I think that explains some of the liberties I've taken in terms of like making us into a couple and things like that. So maybe now is the time to tell her about this.
Heather, if you're listening, get in touch, send us your own early work, and we can read the other side of the story.
God, that would be amazing if it turned out she had
also written these stories. Books, yeah.
Yeah.
And those ones weirdly just have really abrupt beginnings but end quite flabbily.
Yeah.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute treat. I hope Heather's out there. I hope she listens.
Me too, yeah.
So there it was, Mark Watson's early work. Kukriki. I think you could all agree that was exceptional. So exceptional, I nearly fainted, especially when he revealed that he saw two naked people called Adam and Eve. What a genuine coincidence that I brought in two poems to potentially read. They were both quite short, so I wasn't sure which one to do. One was about time, the first line of which is, time doesn't really exist. We've just heard about time travel in Mark's thing. And the other one was literally about the Garden of Eden. Either one would have been... just unbelievably appropriate to read to Mark after the stuff he'd written. It's just that I got to those topics 10 years later than he did, at least, sometimes 11. If I could have given him a 10 out of 5 for the Mickey Mouse Club score, I would have done. Nothing has represented someone in this more than that. I mean, everything he did was so on brand. It was absolutely unreal. As ever, give the podcast a rating. Give it 5 out of 5 if you want. Treat it like Uber. You wouldn't give an Uber driver 4, would you? Come on, I'm a good guy. I dropped you off, didn't I? I got you where you were trying to go. That's what podcasts are, really, isn't it? Just A to B. Also, make sure to subscribe. Make sure to pass the pod. As ever, pass the pod. That's what they say on the Peter Crouch podcast. And as ever, I'm asking you to pass the pod. But don't pass it to a friend. Pass it to Peter Crouch and then watch him nod it in at the back post. Seriously, tell Peter Crouch about the podcast and let's see if he's got any early work and get him on it. I'm not joking. Pass the pod to Crouch. He's got a high profile. I want his listeners. He's got the biggest podcast. Let's not fuck about with any of this. Oh, pass it to your mate. I don't care about your mate. Your little mate isn't going to help me get the numbers I'm looking to get here. Okay, I'm trying to make some ad revenue, for Christ's sake. And he doesn't make any because that's on the BBC. Pass the pod to Crouch. I can't stress it enough. Pass it to Crouch. And I'll see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsedis.
Kayla
It's Sinners. I'm Kellett Sinners, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.